his own intelligence service trying to do the same. Of course, as soon as Drexler arrived, he was thoroughly vetted by Syria's notorious Mukhabarat, their general intelligence service, but he was cleared, and then he began doing the bidding of both Shakira and Ahmed. And he began working with the Mukhabarat on operations that involved keeping the foreign assets of the first family secure. There were a great number of threats to the Azzam's offshore finances. Government entities searching for them, reporters inquiring about them, third-party banks with questions about the legitimacy of the nominees on the trust. Over time, Drexler developed a large network of European employees to further the Azzam's aims on the continent. Cops in Paris, intelligence officials in the UK, corrupt lawyers in Luxembourg, computer hackers in Ukraine. Shakira's accounts stayed safe, and more money was funneled into them from time to time from the Azzam's corruption schemes in Damascus. This relationship between Drexler and the Azzam's had been working well for all parties involved, and the Swiss contract agent had been fully busy with his tasks when an affair between the First Lady and Drexler developed. From Shakira's side, it was easy to see what fueled the desire. She was a woman locked away in a palace with few around her other than sycophants who were completely beholden to her loveless husband. When dangerous but exotic Drexler came into the picture, he met her gaze and showed his interest in her, and unlike other men, he was allowed confidential meetings with her in her private apartment. It took no time for her to make a move on the attractive European. Drexler, on the other hand, was motivated by a combination of two simple drugs, adrenaline and lust. He'd slept with a warlord's mistress, a concubine of the Egyptian president, the wife of a Nigerian general, and even the daughter of the chief Interpol inspector in Greece in charge of his case. Sebastian Drexler was a hunter of pelts, and Shakira was suitable for hanging over his mantle. There was nothing special about their affair to him. He'd had better, but over time he had come to worry that the cold and cruel woman might actually think she was in love with him. And in the dead of night, he found this more terrifying than the prospect that Ahmed Azzam could find out about the affair and have him killed. Sleeping with the First Lady had been the riskiest thing in Sebastian Drexler's life of danger a year earlier, when Shakira summoned him to her offices and asked him for discreet help on a delicate, personal matter. Drexler, only too glad to ingratiate himself even further to the First Lady and thereby solidify himself as a fixture in the Syrian regime, heeded the strange request to track down a Spanish woman living in Damascus and find out just what she was up to. It seemed like it would be easy work. Shakira had made an enemy of some woman here in her country. She did not want to go through official channels to pursue what Drexler assumed was nothing more than a catfight, and he figured he'd have the matter taken care of in a couple of days. He could not have been more wrong. Drexler conducted a tail on Bianca Medina, doing most of the legwork himself, and he slowly came to the realization that this squabble between two women was, in fact, something much more. The first tip-off was the high-level security protection. Medina never went anywhere without a special group of Alawi close protection officers ringing her. For a civilian, this was unheard of in Damascus. His research into the detail showed him they were being paid for out of a special fund at a bank owned by high-ranking members of the ruling Ba'ath Party, and this worried Drexler even more than the security itself. But he continued because the First Lady was not one to piss off, and if his employers at Meyer Privatbank ever heard that he wasn't doing as instructed by their client, there would be hell to pay in Gstaad as well as in Damascus. His surveillance of the woman's home in the Meza 86 neighborhood told him she didn't seem to leave the house for work, and although she was single and she loved the nightlife, she definitely wasn't connected to a large group of friends or acquaintances. She frequented the best clubs and restaurants in the city, but she always returned home alone, surrounded by her guards. Drexler determined that unless she was sleeping with one of her protection detail, she was celibate. And then, on the eighth day of his coverage, his worries that this operation might turn into something delicate were confirmed. Around midnight, he noticed three nondescript vehicles rolling along Said bin Al-Khattab Avenue in Bianca Medina's neighborhood. Through his night vision binoculars, he saw that they bore plates indicating they were owned by the Presidential Security Force. When the detail turned into the circular drive in front of Medina's property, Drexler's apprehension grew. And when the Alawi Private Security Force left the house minutes later, the Swiss agent began to have grave concerns that he knew what was going on. His fears were proven right when two more vehicles pulled into the property just after. President Ahmed Al-Azam himself climbed out and entered the home. So, there it was. The president of Syria was clearly having an affair with this 25-year-old Spanish model, and Drexler's client in this matter was the president's wife. He knew instantly he had found himself between the biggest rock and the hardest place of his entire, exceptionally dangerous career. He could lie to the First Lady, say he learned nothing about Bianca Medina. Or he could inform on the president of Syria, a man who could have him shot and dumped in a ditch whenever he wanted. Drexler immediately went back to the First Lady and told her that because of his obligation to his mission working to protect the assets held in Meyer Privatbank, he no longer had the time he needed to devote to this personal side mission. This ruse lasted about 5 seconds. He'd known Shakira was an intelligent woman, but he'd not been prepared for how quickly she saw through his bullshit.
Ahmed showed up at her house, didn't he? She asked.
Ahmed? You mean your husband? Was Drexler's too casual reply, and he cursed himself for being so transparent. To his shock, though, Shakira just smiled a little.
I knew about the affair. I won't tell you how I knew. Nothing scientific. Woman's intuition, I guess. I thought perhaps you could bring me proof of the extent of it.
There was no way Drexler was going to continue spying on Bianca Medina, not even for the second most powerful person in his patron nation. He replied,
I do not feel comfortable doing that. You understand. I'm certain that President Azam could make serious trouble for me.
Shakira shrugged, then kissed her lover.
You're sleeping with his wife. You think this is worse?
Drexler said, Here, in your apartment. Your husband isn't going to find out what I'm doing unless you tell him. But out there, running surveillance on his mistress, I will be detected, and that will be seen as a hostile act.
Shakira sighed and shrugged.
No matter. What you have done has been more than enough.
This confused Drexler, and he pulled back out of her grasp angrily.
What have I done? I have no photographs, no information of what exactly is taking place.
Now Shakira's smile was genuine.
You try telling Ahmed that. I won't tell him that I know of his affair with Bianca, but if he does ever find out, I know. He'll probably assume my own personal intelligence agent was the one who informed on him.
It was a chilling comment, and Drexler did not know how to process it. But Shakira released Drexler from his duties regarding Medina that very night, and this relaxed him greatly. He returned to his work for the General Intelligence Service and the interests of Shakira's accounts at Meyer Privatbank, and he considered himself lucky to be clear of the danger of reporting against one of his benefactors to his other. But it was just months later when he was with Shakira in her private quarters. They were both nude and covered in a thin sheen of sweat. Around them, the Egyptian cotton bedsheets were twisted and balled and damp, pillows strewn about the floor. Drexler was deep in the after effects of post-coital calm, and not in the mood for a serious talk. But while Drexler had been in charge during their lovemaking, the second the sex was over, she reacquired her air of authority and detachment. As a complete non sequitur, Shakira sat up in the bed.
I've heard a rumor, Sebastian, and I need you to find out if it's true.
Any chance I can take a shower first?
When Shakira told him that she had learned Bianca was pregnant, Drexler was incredulous. He could envision no scenario where Ahmed would allow a mistress to have his baby. But Shakira felt differently. She worried that a boy was on the way, and a boy was a threat to her children, to her own power in the nation. If Drexler had been uncomfortable earlier with the prospect of informing on the president to his wife about an affair, now he was out of his mind with the quandary he found himself in. He was in a corner, but he went to work. He began digging, hoping like hell there was no pregnancy, no child, but after a time he found, to his horror, that the mistress had indeed given Azam a son. And in the worst news of all, the boy was named after Ahmed's father, the man who'd ruled Syria for 35 years, Instantly, Drexler knew for certain he had information that Ahmed Al-Azam would kill to keep under wraps. He worried about telling Shakira, but she demanded information, and he knew she could make things difficult at Meyer if he did not reveal what he knew. Drexler found himself once again in the center of a very dangerous game, so he did what he had to do. He picked a side. He knew that telling Shakira about baby Jamal would not give her reason to kill him, but if he told Ahmed Azam about his discovery, the Syrian president might just kill him for finding out. When he told her the news, she took it stoically, then said,
"The only reason Ahmed has kept me around is because of my relationship in the Sunni community. When the war is over, when the Russians and Iranians have pushed out all the foreign threats, then he won't need the help of the Sunni groups any longer. Think about it, Sebastian. If he starts a new family with his young Alawi concubine and his new child, what do you suppose he will do with me? And if something happens to me, what will happen to you? You know too much."
"Only because you made me an accessory after the fact," Drexler raged inside. Shakira continued, thinking about all aspects of her and Drexler's shared predicament.
"And what of the money at Meyer Privatbank? After all, it was you, their agent, who found out about the affair. Do you think Ahmed will leave the 100 million euros in Switzerland, knowing that they have this information about him? He will kill me, take the money from your bank, and you will be here in Syria with no benefactor at home or abroad. You will be a loose end."
It occurred to Drexler that if he could only get away with strangling Shakira Azam to death right then and there, it would solve a lot of his problems. But it wouldn't solve all of them, and he would not get far. Certainly not out of Syria. Drexler understood that for now at least, his personal fortunes were inexorably tied to the continued good health and good standing of the First Lady.
"What do you propose we do?" he asked.
"Stopping this woman is the only way to safeguard the account at Meyer. And that is your job, is it not?"
He shrugged, despondent now. She leaned forward to him with a conspiratorial look.
"We're in this together, Sebastian. We need to find a way to get rid of Bianca."
The Swiss man looked at her like she was crazy.
"How does that help you? If you kill his lover, you think that will make you safe?"
"He can't know I did it, but once she's gone, then I'll be secure. You don't know Ahmed. He is in love with this girl. Foolish, reckless love. He is too insulated now to ever find anyone else. The Russians want stability in his regime, and that means me in the palace, smoothing things over with the Sunnis. Ahmed will fight the Russians over his infatuation with that Spanish bitch. But he won't go back to the drawing board if something happens to her."
Drexler resigned to his fate, began working for Shakira Azam. But try as he might, he was not able to discover the location of the child. Bianca owned a home in Meza 86, directly south of the palace, but it was locked and darkened now. Wherever she and her child were being kept, it was likely someplace ultra-secret Azam had set up for her. And for Shakira's part, she knew she could never kill Medina in Syria. Ahmed would learn of her involvement and that would spell disaster for her. But when Drexler found out that Ahmed Azam's lover would be traveling to France, he helped Shakira concoct a scheme to co-opt ISIS into killing her by framing her as the concubine of the Emir of Kuwait, sworn enemies of the Islamic State. Drexler had been sitting in his palace office brooding over the events of the past 2 years when the encrypted voice app on his mobile phone rang. He snatched it up, although he knew what he would hear.
"Oui?"
As expected, it was Henri Sauvage on the other line.
"Eric, something's happened."
Drexler listened to the police captain for several minutes without reply, as he reported the deaths of Allard and Foss. Sauvage closed his report by saying,
"No video of the incident, but the police officers on the scene say this man, this American, he's something else."
"Keep working on finding Medina," Drexler instructed.
"Damn it, man, this is big. Two of my men are dead, and French intelligence is working with the FSEU.
"Wait, French intelligence? What do you mean by that?"
A guy was rooting around the 36th this afternoon, asking questions about Foss and Allard. I didn't know who he was, but my superiors gave him the run of the place. After he left, I found out he was a recently retired internal security spook.
Name? Drexler asked.
Guys like that don't drop names, Eric.
Drexler thought a moment.
Answer me this. Was he mid-60s, short with wavy silver hair, a faux highborn act but chewed fingernails? A pause. You know him? His name is Vincent Voland. I've never met him, but I know him well. Listen, Savage replied. I didn't sign on for street battles and dead cops and old spymasters rooting around my office. I don't want any part of any of this anymore.
Neither did Drexler, but although he found himself sympathetic to Sauvage's sentiment, he knew he needed the man's compliance.
You aren't going anywhere, Henri, and we both know why.
Just as Shakira had something on Drexler that she could use to doom him, Drexler had something on Sauvage. Evidence of all the crimes he'd committed on Syria's behalf. The little stuff at first, the bigger stuff in the middle, and then the events of the past 24 hours.
No,
Drexler knew Savage was in his back pocket. The Swiss agent said,
I'm coming up. Find Bianca Medina before I get there.
But, Drexler hung up the phone. Just then, his assistant spoke over the speakerphone on his desk.
Mr. Drexler?
Yes.
Sir, the president's office called. President Azam would like to speak with you privately this evening, 11 p.m. in his office.
Although his heart began hammering inside his chest, for the first time that day, Sebastian Drexler smiled. Chapter 19. 65-year-old Vincent Voland breathed the vapor of the rainy evening, walking alone along the wet cobblestones as he approached the lighted side of Tettazioni, an intimate Italian restaurant at the top of a steep and narrow lane in Montmartre. The restaurant was nearly empty at 10 p.m., but tonight's meeting was set for this venue at this time. Tarek Alabi had called Voland just after his and his wife's encounter with the two police judiciaire officers working for Syrian interests. He'd explained how the American had shown up minutes before the attack, then again during the attack, and about how he'd saved them both. Tarek then demanded a face-to-face meeting tonight, leaving it to Voland to determine the time and the place, and the Frenchman had picked this restaurant because of its small size, the visibility afforded by its windows, and its intimate atmosphere. Voland knew Tettazioni well. He would sense immediately if anyone here did not belong, and he could then simply snake off down one of the nearby side streets and alleys and disappear. The Halabis themselves weren't particularly safe in Paris now, but Voland felt this locale would be quiet enough where they could get in and get out without encountering police or other interested parties. The silver-haired Frenchman stopped in a wide patch of misty darkness, just down the Rue Lepique from the restaurant, far enough from the lights and tourists of the Sacré-Cœur up the hill to the east. As he stood there, he looked into the windows of the little Italian eatery. There were just a few tables occupied, but Voland did not see either of the Halabis yet. This surprised him. The Syrian couple knew next to nothing about tradecraft, so he didn't give them credit for the play of showing up late for a meet to scout the location from afar. He backed into the darkness along the sidewalk next to a simple storefront undergoing construction, and looked down to his phone to dial Tarek on a secure voice app. But just as he lit up the screen, he felt the cold tip of a pistol suppressor touch him at the base of his skull. He flinched, then immediately froze, afraid to make any movement that would cause the person at the other end of the weapon to pull the trigger. He spoke softly in the dark, still afraid to alarm whoever had a gun to his neck. Softly he said,
D'où viens-tu?
Where did you come from? The reply was delivered in English.
From somewhere in your past.
Voland closed his eyes in an attempt to block out the fear, because he understood instantly what was happening. The gray man had him at gunpoint, and, perhaps even more importantly, the gray man had him figured out. He responded softly, lest he excite the man who held his life in his hand.
The Halabis told you how to find me?
They owed me a favor.
Oui.
They certainly did. I heard about what you did to earn that favor. Two dead PJ investigators? By your hand, I assume.
My hand? No. By the weapon pressed against your spine.
Ah, I see.
Let's go.
Where are we go?
A rough hand grabbed Voland by the shoulder and yanked him backwards. Court directed the man off the street and into the old building undergoing remodeling. Here he pushed Voland up to a wall that smelled like fresh plaster and stale rainwater, and he fished through the man's raincoat. He pulled his wallet while keeping the man pinned to the wall with the pistol pressed hard against his forehead. As he fumbled with the wallet, he said,
I probably don't need to tell you that I can pull the trigger before you can grab the gun.
Non, monsieur. You do not need to tell me a thing about your abilities.
Court looked into the man's eyes at this, then went back to his work. He one-handed the wallet open and held it close to his face so he could read it in the golden glow of filtered streetlight.
Vincent Voland, that's your real name?
It is. I thought you knew who I was.
Only in the general sense. You are French intelligence, you think you know something about me, and you hired me through my cutout in Monte Carlo because, in your estimation, I was the only guy out there who could have pulled off last night while those ISIS shitheads were attacking.
I am not French intelligence, currently, but I was.
And what do you do now, Monsieur Voland?
I am a private consultant.
Yeah? Court leaned close, menacing. Well, I'd say I'm in need of some consultation right about now.
The older man was nervous. Court could see the tells even in the low light, but Voland affected a little smile.
I am not currently seeking new clients.
Too busy leading Rima and Tarek to their deaths.
That is unfair,
Voland replied. The gray man was talking, not shooting, so Court could see the Frenchman's fear about his predicament fading away, and he was growing a little less terrified, even though there was still a pistol pointed at his head.
What do you know about me? Court asked.
Voland's eyes narrowed now. He knew something, but didn't seem certain how he should answer. Finally, he said,
I know you used to be an American intelligence asset, and I know that the CIA has disavowed you.
His information was old and incomplete, Court realized, but he had no intention of bringing him up to date.
Anything else?
Yes, I know about Normandy.
Court chewed the inside of his lip.
What do you know about Normandy?
2 years ago, I was an executive with DGSI.
Court knew this was French domestic intelligence.
Go on.
I was involved in the investigation of a series of murders here in Paris, and then a massacre at a chateau in Normandy. It was determined that the man at the center of it all was the rogue American intelligence asset known informally as the Gray Man.
When Court did not reply, Voland added,
And all that killing, of course, was done by you.
Still, Court said nothing. Voland nodded and smiled.
Nicely done, by the way. The bodies recovered were a wide array of criminals and scum. Businessmen with nefarious connections and foreign paramilitaries involved in all manner of illegal activity on French soil.
He shrugged.
The police here would still love to get their hands on you, even before what you did last night, and again today. But as for our intelligence services, let's just say we've moved on to more pressing matters than Normandy.
Court knew he should have denied all involvement in the incident Voland spoke of, but his thoughts were on the present, not the past.
I'm not here to talk about 2 years ago.
The Frenchman nodded.
I understand. And I must thank you for what you did today for the Halabis. As their consultant, I suppose we should talk about you getting a hefty bonus for your work.
Court lowered his pistol finally, and holstered it inside the waistband at his right hip.
And I'm not here because I want money.
Then you have me at a loss. Why are you here?
I'm here to figure you out. It's obvious the Halabis are being manipulated by someone in all this. My guess is that someone is you. My survival depends on me having an understanding of who knows what about me. The Halabis don't know anything, but you seem to know it all.
Why do you care about the Halabis and their objective?
Court looked off out the window into the night.
I'll be damned if I know.
Turning back to Voland, he said, "How about you? What's your interest in all this?"
"The Syrian exiles are my clients. Can't it be as simple as that?"
"Nope. If that were the case, you'd do what they told you to do. But I've seen enough to know that you are using them for your own agenda. I want to know what that agenda is, and who is pulling your strings." Voland gave an exaggerated shrug.
"My nation is very energized to bring Al-Azam down, as is yours, by the way. Both of our countries have troops in Syria.
Fighting the Islamic State, not the Syrian army."
"Very true. It is a complicated situation. My nation has no official policy supporting the decapitation of the Syrian regime. We can't be involved in making a bad situation even worse. There are enough refugees in Europe as things stand. If a new flood came in, our current government would fall in the next elections. But behind the scenes, in a deniable fashion, France wants an end to the refugee crisis, and creating a rift between the Iranians, the Russians, and the Azam regime would be a good beginning."
Kort shook his head. "There is more. What are you really trying to accomplish?" Voland nodded softly, as if giving himself permission to reveal more information.
"There is someone close to the First Lady of Syria, Shakira Al-Azam. A Westerner. He is the one who communicated secretly with ISIS in Belgium about Bianca Medina. The Halabis know nothing about him, but he is a secondary objective for me in this operation."
Kort leaned closer to Voland. "The man I spoke with on the phone, Rima said he used the name Eric.
A pseudonym."
"Who is he?"
"Does the name Sebastian Drexler mean anything to you?"
Kort turned away and began slowly pacing the dark and unfinished room.
"Holy hell,"
the Frenchman said.
"Ah, I thought it just might."
"I guess it stands to reason Drexler would be involved with Azam. He's worked for every other son-of-a-bitch dictator around."
"Exactement. He is a very dangerous man, and he is wanted for crimes in many countries, but no one wants him more than me."
"Why?"
"The last 4 years of my time in DGSI, my job was to find and arrest Sebastian Drexler. I got close multiple times in Africa, but I failed. I am not one who gives up easily, so I continue to hunt the man, even while no longer employed by the French government."
"What sort of crimes has he committed here?"
"I am not clear to tell you, but suffice it to say crimes that were costly, embarrassing, and damaging to the French people."
Instantly, Kort could think of a half dozen major imbroglios the French government had been caught up in during the last decade. With Iraq, with Libya, with Egypt. Knowing what the infamous Sebastian Drexler was capable of, Kort imagined the Swiss national could have quite possibly been the culprit for one or all of these. "So are you using this operation with the Halabis to draw Drexler back into France?"
"With Shakira Azam as his benefactor in Damascus, I think it likely that her desperation over this operation will entice her to force Drexler to come here in person, to locate Medina."
Kort said, "If it were anyone else, I'd have to ask you why you were going through all this for one guy, but Drexler? I get it."
"I feel confident Drexler will come."
Kort looked Voland over. "It's just you working with the Halabis. No one else from French intelligence. No one to support them if Drexler comes up here with 50 assholes." Voland chuckled.
"First, as I said, I am no longer officially with French intelligence. I am just helping them with this objective. And second, Drexler can't get 50, as you say, assholes into France."
"No offense, dude, but there are a lot more than 50 assholes already in France. I'm looking at one of them right now, as a matter of fact. You double-crossed me yesterday when you didn't tell me ISIS was planning to hit that night, and you are double-crossing the Free Syria Exile Union now for France's own self-interests." That sank in a moment, till Voland said,
"It is only me. French intelligence has been hands-off with the Halabis and their organization because of the delicacy of the situation with the rebel groups in Syria. We can't be discovered assisting an extremist movement."
Cort fired back. I'd say Tarek and Rima are about as far from extreme as you can get and still be involved in a civil war.
Yes, but politics being what it is in this country, the government's opposition could frame this poorly if word got out. The FSEU has a half dozen former Syrian rebels guarding Bianca in a safe house right now, and they will remain in place until she talks. That should do, as long as they keep their location hidden.
Really, the FSEU are a fine group when it comes to getting money together for food, weapons, logistics, and such. But they aren't a fighting force, and they aren't an intelligence organization.
Which is why they got tricked by the ex-employee of an intelligence organization.
Voland shook his head.
No one tricked them. I was told in confidence by an associate in DGSI that Drexler had notified the ISIS cell in Belgium about Medina's travels here. ISIS doesn't know she is Ahmed's mistress. They were told she was having an affair with the Emir of Kuwait.
But French intelligence knew about the affair.
Correct. My contact at DGSI knew I was consulting for the Free Syria Exile Union, and he knew the Halabis had the resources and zeal to transform their group into something more effective than a relief organization. So I used them as cover to hire you to rescue Medina.
Why did Tarek and Rima transform a relief organization to a direct action arm of the rebels? What is it they aren't telling me?
Voland nodded now in the dim light.
You are a very perceptive man.
I get lied to a lot. I'm used to looking for ulterior motives.
The elder Frenchman himself began pacing the room.
The Halabi's two children, a son and a daughter, were young doctors here in Paris. They began going on medical aid missions to Syria for the FSEU. They spent a lot of time treating civilians wounded in the fighting.
He heaved his chest and sighed.
They were killed last fall, when the hospital in Aleppo where they were working was flattened by Russian bombs.
Jesus, Cort muttered.
When Tarek and Rima's children were killed, they could no longer avoid involvement in the war itself. They started raising money for weapons and other equipment in the West, sneaking it over the border with their relief supplies.
And then he added,
I was hired to facilitate this operation. And then along the way, I learned about Medina Drexler and the ISIS plan. I arranged to bring you in to help with that.
And here we are, Cort said.
Here we are, Voland confirmed.
Now they want me to go in and get the baby.
Voland cracked a smile now, as if this were the most ridiculous notion he'd ever heard of.
Of course they do. The operation to compromise Azam's secret talks with the Iranians will only go forward with Medina's help, and they will not allow me to use enhanced techniques on the woman. It would be a boon to the Halabi's operation if you'd go to Syria and rescue this child, but personally, I think it utter madness.
I want to talk to Bianca, Cort declared flatly.
For what purpose?
For the purpose of determining my level of madness.
Voland was gobsmacked.
So, there is a chance you will go to Damascus?
There's a greater chance I'll get on the next bus leaving town.
Monsieur, if you go to Syria, you will die.
Cort repeated himself.
I want to talk to Bianca.
Very well. I can arrange this.
It was silent in the unfinished room for several seconds. Then Voland said,
Ah! You mean now?
I do mean now.
Chapter 20. President of the Syrian Arab Republic, Ahmed al-Azam, was a tall and thin man, always impeccably dressed, but his fashion acumen did little for him, because he had yellowish skin and a seemingly constant 5 o'clock shadow. Even as he sat behind the massive walnut desk in his expansive office, amid art and antiquities and bodyguards and tailored business suits, he still did not look the part of the leader of his nation. Sebastian Drexler had met him a few times before, and he was always left with the same impression, whereas Shakira Azam was a beautiful, mature woman, classically featured, and with an air of brightness about her. Ahmed Azam looked grim and disengaged, even when he smiled. He looked less like Shakira's husband and more like her uncle, the Undertaker. But today, he appeared even more drawn and anxious than usual. Drexler knew why, but he pretended like he did not. The Swiss operative fought the Undertaker imagery now as he sat in Ahmed Azam's large palace office, facing the man with the two narrow eyes and the too thin chin. Drexler was here on a mission, and the mission required him to be taken into Ahmed's confidence. So Drexler merely smiled back. Azam motioned to the tea service on the corner of his desk, and then he reached for one of the empty cups. Holding his hand around it, he said,
"You are well, Mr. Drexler?"
Four male attendants stood close by, and one poured for both men, while the other three kept their eyes on the foreigner and their hands near the pistols inside their jackets. When the tea was poured, Azam ignored it, so Drexler did as well. He said,
"I am very well, sir. Thank you for inquiring. Our lovely weather is to your liking, I assume."
The daily highs in Damascus this time of year were in the low 80s, and the lows in the mid-50s. It was indeed beautiful weather, Drexler had to admit, although he would have given it up in a heartbeat to stand in a snowstorm in his homeland.
"Damascus is an oasis, Mr. President."
Azam's little mouth stretched into a forced smile.
"I am hearing interesting things about you from my people in the Mukhabarat."
Drexler's chest tightened. No one likes to hear that a nation's intelligence service is saying anything about them to the president of the nation, but even less so when the person in question is targeting the president's mistress and sleeping with his wife. He wondered if Azam had brought him here only to tell him he was to be executed. Drexler managed to force out a neutral enough.
"Is that so?" "Yes. My people in GIS tell me you have been helping them out on some operations in Europe with your contacts there. Work that is above and beyond your duties on the finance side. You have my personal gratitude for your assistance. As you are well aware, this is a difficult time for our nation. Your connections overseas are crucial to our operations to keep Syria strong."
Drexler relaxed somewhat. It didn't sound like he was about to be trucked off to the notorious Sadnaya prison for execution after all.
"It has been an honor to serve Syria, and to live in this amazing city and nation. I owe you a personal debt of gratitude for that."
Azam bit an unruly fingernail, then took a sip of tea that proved to be clearly too hot, so he put it down. He nodded distractedly.
"I have a new operation for you and your contacts. It takes place in Europe, and it needs to be done quickly and with discretion."
"Mr. President, I will do my best, but it is difficult for me to travel in Europe. Nevertheless, as you know, I have people all over the continent. My best efforts and my best contacts are at your disposal."
Azam kept biting at his nail.
"I wonder if there might be a way for you to possibly go yourself."
Drexler pretended to think on the question, but in truth, he was marveling on the fact that this was going even better than he'd hoped.
"Yes, sir. As a matter of fact, there is a way. I have discussed with your Mukhabarat what I would need if I were ever called upon by your government for a personal mission into one of the nations where Interpol has impeded my safe travel. Tell me the procedure you would use."
Sebastian Drexler did so, giving Azam a quick layman's explanation for a complicated operation, and the Syrian president actually smiled and even gasped once while listening to the details.
"You seem to know all about this,"
Azam said, when Drexler was finished, and this unnerved Drexler a little. The procedure he outlined was a means to get into Europe, and for Drexler to know it so well, he wondered if Azam suspected he might have been preparing to flee Damascus and return home at some point. But Drexler sold his knowledge of the method as more professional necessity than an actual plan of action.
"Mr. President, if there were a book written on this procedure, I would have been the one to write it. I have been working on this with doctors and scientists for 5.5 years, beginning back when I was living in Sudan.
But it's untested."
"We've tested it. We sent agents to Europe 2 times using this method, and both times we were successful.
Now Azam nodded enthusiastically.
Oh, then we shall use this procedure to move you into Europe.
Thank you, sir. Obviously, it will require some significant resources to accomplish. So, I assume it is something that would only be approved in the case of a national emergency.
Approved, Azam said with a hand wave. How quickly can you go?
Drexler feigned surprise.
Well, depending on the nature of your operational necessities, I can begin preparing the resources immediately. It will take several hours to get the equipment and people in place and brief them, but I could be on the plane leaving Damascus within 24 to 36 hours of you authorizing the mission.
Azam gave a squirrely, awkward smile.
Then the day after tomorrow you will leave. Time is critical, you see.
Drexler nodded, and then he hesitated before asking the next question.
What can you tell me about the operation, sir?
He was worried about where this would lead, but it would have been inauthentic and suspicious if he did not inquire. Azam looked out his window. From there, he had a good view of the southern districts of Damascus, though they were mostly obscured by darkness.
There is a young woman in Paris who has been kidnapped. Did you hear about the attack there last night?
Yes, of course. It's all over the news. ISIS raided a private hotel, kidnapped a young Spanish fashion model, a very beautiful woman from the pictures on Al Jazeera.
Azam smiled again. Drexler knew him to be an oddball, so he was no longer creeped out by his mannerisms. The Syrian president said,
The media says she was the lover of the Emir of Kuwait, but they have it wrong. That woman is my lover.
Cheat, Drexler thought. He'd hoped the president would send him off with some ruse, but the man seemed unabashedly proud of the truth. Drexler feigned shock for a moment, then said,
My condolences, Mr. President, but I understand the gravity of the situation. I and my team in Europe will find her, and we will bring her back to you.
I know you will, Sebastian. When you get to Paris, of course you will have access to all the resources at our embassy there. And that includes all the men from GIS that you require.
Excellent, Drexler said, but he didn't like hearing this. Men from the General Intelligence Service working in the French embassy would be tasked with rescuing Medina from her captors, whereas Drexler wanted her killed. Still, there was no way he could decline the assistance. Azam leaned forward.
I am watching you carefully to make certain you have everything you need to take care of this. She is a good woman. I fear for her safety. Bring her back to me.
I will do my very best.
Drexler was going to kill Bianca Medina, but he'd be damn certain that the man sitting across the desk from him would never suspect that for an instant.
And breathe not a word of your true mission to anyone.
Certainly not, Mr. President.
I really do mean anyone. I know you work closely with my wife. I also know you understand discretion, and you understand my reach if you let me down.
Of course I do. You can count on me.
Drexler looked across the desk at Azam's thin, awkward smile, and he thought he would be having a lot of nightmares about that face in the days and weeks to come. Drexler left the president's office a minute later with carte blanche to do whatever he wanted in Europe. There wasn't much further left to fall for Azam, reputation-wise or sanction-wise, so if Syrian intelligence agents were caught on a street in France, it would hardly make much difference, diplomatically speaking. Drexler was pleased that the president had done just exactly what he wanted him to do, and his plan was already meeting with success. The one snag was the fact that he would have Syrian intelligence officers with him in Paris every step of the way, but he told himself he'd find a way around this problem. Things would have been so much easier if the damn ISIS gunman had simply managed to shoot Bianca Medina the previous evening, and there was no denying that the next few days would be dangerous for Drexler, but he was a man who was accustomed to adversity, and accustomed to surviving, and even thriving in danger. He left the president's wing of the palace and began walking to the first lady's wing. She'd be there, waiting for him, wanting to know what her husband had told him.
He told himself he'd fuck her before he said a word, to demonstrate that he retained some power in the relationship outside the bedroom, even if it was just making her wait to hear his news. Chapter 21. Vincent Voland himself drove Court to the safe house outside the city, leaving first the traffic and lights of Paris, and then the modern highway to the south before taking a side road through the countryside. At 11 p.m., they passed by the tiny hamlet of Valmurey, and soon afterward Court saw a road sign for La Brosse. Before they reached the village, however, Voland turned the Citroën into a narrow gravel drive all but hidden by thick woods. The driveway wound through the trees for a quarter mile before it passed a long greenhouse illuminated only by the vehicle's headlights. Court tried to peer into the black beyond the illumination, but he didn't see any hint of the main house until they were within 100 feet of it. It seemed to be a large structure, but there was no electric lighting outside, and either the windows were all covered or there was no power running to the property at all. As Voland slowed the vehicle over loose stones, a single light flipped on at a side door of the house, next to the gravel parking circle. Under it, a man in a brown leather jacket stood with a pump shotgun hanging from a sling over his shoulder. The wall behind him was covered in ivy, and the stone building looked like a large and well-built farmhouse. A motion light flipped on, and Court saw two other security men standing around in the dark outside. One had an old Uzi, and the other wore a pistol in a shoulder holster. As Voland parked the Citroën, Court looked over what he could see of the grounds and the farmhouse. This is too big to be private property owned by the FSEU. This looks like some kind of government safe house. Voland pulled the parking brake and turned off the ignition.
Government property, but not government run. My consulting firm rented it from DGSI through a front company, and we in turn have loaned it out to the Halabi's organization.
French intel is all over this op. When are you going to tell me that you've been lying and this whole thing is government-sanctioned?
Voland surprised Court by laughing at this.
Perhaps you have forgotten, but less than 24 hours ago, a large cell of ISIS terrorists from Belgium perpetrated an attack in France that led to a great number of deaths. If you think the French government knew about the ISIS attack in advance, and then simply allowed it to take place in central Paris, then you've been watching too many bad movies. No, monsieur. That was me alone, and one of the most difficult decisions I've had to make in my career.
Voland sounded sure of himself, but Court harbored suspicions nonetheless. He followed the older man through the side door, past the bearded man with the shotgun. Once inside, Court found the building to be a well-kept, medium-sized farmhouse, stately, but certainly not garish. The lights were on, but every window had thick blackout curtains drawn. Rima and Tara Kalabi stood in the kitchen by the stove, but the middle-aged couple approached Court warmly as soon as he entered. Court could still see the strain on Rima's face, but she had some of the color back she'd lost earlier in the day, when three men died right in front of her. She hugged Court, a Western act that turned into a somewhat awkward gesture considering the fact that Court just stood there with his hands to his sides and his eyebrows so furrowed they almost touched. Both of the Halabis thanked him again for saving their lives earlier in the day, and Rima poured him tea. Court ignored the tea.
I'd like to talk to Bianca in private.
Why privately?
Rima asked, suddenly on guard.
Because I want her to tell me where her kid is, and I think she might do it if I can get her to trust me.
Does this mean you will go and rescue the child?
There was obvious hopefulness in Tarek's voice.
Let's not get ahead of ourselves.
Rima led Court into the kitchen, then through a doorway off it, down a flight of wooden stairs adorned with a tattered red rug that looked like it predated the reign of Napoleon. Court found himself in a large and well-stocked wine cellar. Rima nodded to a young guard with a beard and a ponytail sitting at a table between two heavy wooden doors. The man looked at Court suspiciously, then stood and produced an old brass key on a big ring. The young man said something to Rima in Arabic, but Court's command of the language was rudimentary, so he didn't understand. Rima turned to him.
He wants to know if you have a gun or a mobile phone.
We can't let Bianca have access to either for the obvious reasons.
Court wanted to tell her that Bianca wasn't going to get his gun or his phone off him, but instead he obliged. He pulled out his Glock and laid it on the table next to the door, then pulled out his phone and put it down next to the gun. Both the guard and the co-director of the resistance organization were satisfied, so the key went into the lock. Court cleared his throat, and both Syrians looked back to him. The American lifted his right foot and rested it on the table's edge, reached down to his ankle, and pulled a stainless steel snub-nosed .38 pistol out of its holster. This he put on the table next to his primary weapon. Then he reached into his jacket and pulled out a second, and then a third phone. These he put on the table as well. A folding knife came out of his waistband, and he tossed this next to the phones. Court eyed the man in the ponytail. On the first day of sentry school, they teach you not to use the honor system. Rima said,
"This is my nephew, Fierce. He's a school teacher by trade."
"Tell him he shouldn't quit his day job," Court said, but Rima did not translate. Court turned back to the heavy wooden door, and Fierce opened it. He was shocked by how much Bianca Medina had changed in the 24 hours since he'd last seen her. She wore jeans and a beige sweater that was too short for her 5'10" frame, and she lay sprawled across a small bed in the small room. She looked tired, drawn. She wore no makeup, and he could see the dark circles under her eyes that told him she hadn't slept in nearly 2 days. The wall behind her was the stone outer wall of the farmhouse, and the floors were cold tile. The room smelled like damp stone. A private bathroom looked well-kept, and there was an uneaten plate of fish and rice that had been brought down for Bianca from the kitchen. An empty bottle of champagne sat on the table, and not a brand a top European fashion model would normally drink, Court determined. Someone, Court presumed it was Bianca herself, had meticulously picked at the label until it lay torn in little bits on the table. She clearly wasn't being mistreated here, but it wasn't much of an existence for someone who was accustomed to living well. Upon recognizing the American who fought her away from the Syrian guards and the Islamic State attackers the evening before, she pushed herself up to a sitting position and spoke in English.
"I didn't expect to see you again."
Court slid a simple wooden chair closer to her and sat down. "Did you hear what happened today?"
"I haven't heard anything. No one will talk to me."
A pair of local police detectives working on behalf of either Ahmed or Shakira Azam attacked the Halabis. They were looking for you. Bianca rubbed her red eyes, although no tears drained from them.
"Ahmed won't rest until I am found. I guess Shakira won't rest until I'm dead."
She asked the next question in a matter-of-fact tone.
"How are the Halabis?"
"They survived, this time. The two Paris detectives were killed."
"Let me take a guess. You killed them, right?"
Court did not answer. She reached over into a plastic cooler next to her bed, and from it she pulled out a fresh bottle of champagne. Water dripped from the bottle, but she ignored the mess as it collected on the floor and on her jeans. While Court looked on, she expertly removed the foil, the wire, and the cork. Off his look, Bianca said,
"I wanted something to help me relax. I meant Xanax, Valium. They brought me scotch."
She sniffed wet congestion.
"I put up a fight and got this. Haven't drunk anything so cheap since I was 15 years old."
She gulped from the bottle, then held it out to Court. He just shook his head. Bianca swigged again, then nodded.
"I'm an alcoholic, I guess. Have been since I was a kid. Ahmed used that to his advantage. Among other things, I stayed off booze during the pregnancy, and I was good after Jamal was born, till I came up here."
She shrugged.
"Now look at me."
She put the bottle on the floor between her knees.
"The contaminating influence of the West, I suppose."
"People drink in Syria. It's not exactly Saudi Arabia." Bianca shrugged.
"Yeah, and I was one of them."
She looked up to Court.
"Hey, can you ask them to get me a phone? I want to call Jamal's au pair. My son needs me. I've been gone too long."
Court didn't answer her, There was zero chance this prisoner was going to get a phone to call home, but he wasn't going to tell her that right now. Instead, he said,
"Help me understand. How did you get caught up with Azam in the first place?"
Bianca smiled a little. She was sad, stressed, tired, but Court saw that she could still look beautiful with only a smile.
"My grandfather on my father's side was from Tartus, Syria, on the Mediterranean coast. I visited twice as a child, then 4 years ago I was invited to a party in Damascus. It meant a lot to my parents for me to go, so I went. And I met Shakira. We became friends, and she introduced me to Ahmed. They were very kind to me, treated me like I belonged in their nation. I decided to stay for a season, to show my solidarity for Syria and the Alawis. I am an Alawi, if you did not know."
Court said,
"I knew."
Bianca raised her eyebrows.
"You researched me?"
"I wanted to know if you would put up a fight in the hotel. I thought any religious or tribal affiliations might be relevant. Of course, that was before I was let in on the joke."
"The joke?"
"That I'd be grabbing you at the exact moment the terrorists attacked."
"Ah,"
she said.
"That made everything easy, didn't it?"
"Not everything. Just you."
A look of anger flashed across her face, but it dissipated, and she kept talking.
"I bought a home in Damascus. I wanted to stand against the lies perpetrated by the West against my people. Shakira thanked me personally for my actions. We would have lunch every week, and we went on shopping trips in the city together, if you can believe such a thing now."
She gulped another swig of champagne.
"Then Ahmed asked to see me privately. Of course, I knew what was going on, but I was flattered. He is one of the most important men in the world, obviously."
"He's a psycho,"
Court wanted to say, but he held his tongue. He needed this woman on his side right now.
"Our relationship developed quickly. I'm convinced Shakira knew all along and did not mind."
"Apparently she minds now," Court said.
"Only because of my son. My son is a threat to the future of her children, or at least she thinks he is. Ahmed wants to leave her and bring me into the palace, but it's complicated because of the war. Shakira is Sunni, and she has power with the Sunni groups helping the Alawi government. But when the war is over, when it is safe, he will send Shakira out of the country with some money and her kids. And..."
Her voice trailed off oddly.
"You all right?"
Her eyes went distant.
"I think that's what I wanted once. I don't want that anymore."
Court sat there, patiently, waiting for her. She said,
"I thought I loved Ahmed. I became his mistress and then... slowly I began to feel like a prisoner. I thought it was just because of the war and the Western lies. But when I became pregnant, I thought maybe I should kill myself."
"Why didn't you?"
"I was afraid, I suppose. Then I had Jamal."
Her eyes fixed again and beamed. She stared into Court's eyes, and their brilliance made him uneasy.
"When I saw Jamal, I realized I had never felt love before that moment. I had finally done something right. I finally had a purpose to my life."
She kept looking at Court.
"I am wondering, does a man like you even know what it feels like to love?"
She drank some more champagne from the bottle while she waited for an answer, never taking her eyes from his. Court looked away and changed the subject.
"You still live in your house?"
"No. Ahmed bought me a new home in Damascus, in a neighborhood he can get to quickly and quietly from the palace. Neither his name nor my name are used in the purchase."
"Your baby, he stays with you?"
She cocked her head.
"Of course he stays with me. What kind of question is..."
"Will Ahmed move him now that you've disappeared?"
"He can't. He is careful about Jamal. He uses special guards who work for him directly, so there is no connection back to the presidential palace. It would hurt him with the Sunnis if word got out about his other family, because it would hurt Shakira's standing, and she's the one thing keeping the Sunni militias from rising up against him.
How many security officers at your house?
Why do you ask?
How many?
It depends. About 5 or so.
I want to know everything about your home.
She seemed surprised by the change in the conversation, and she lowered the bottle, held it between her knees.
Why?
Because the Halabis need your help, and the only